Greetings from Bedlam Farm, where hope, encouragement, and creativity flourish like spring flowers in the garden. Wow. I'm John Katz.
And I'm Maria Wolf. Welcome to our podcast.
Well, it sounds kind of warm and folksy. It's spring at Bedlam Farm. Spring has sprung. How do we know?
Because the grass is green and the animals are starting to not want to eat hay because they have enough grass to eat.
So one of the tricky parts about hay is knowing when to stop giving it. Now, I have some friends who have sheep on a farm, and their rule is if the sheep can see the ground, they don't get hay. That can be a little harsh to me.
We're a little more lenient.
We're a little softer. We're a little more new people.
We want to make sure that the sheep and the donkeys get enough to eat.
Now, the sheep are grazing on the grass stubs. There's not a lot of grass. They're probably very nutritious, and you have to be careful because this time of year, they can get sick if they eat too much because there's a lot of sugar in the grass. And so their diet changes very radically.
And it really just turned green, I would say, within the past 2 days. I mean, really green. Every day it's a little greener, but it is still really very short. And we have to make sure that they don't eat it down too far, because then they'll keep the grass from growing completely.
Well, I think also you want to look and see, you know, when I put the hay out yesterday afternoon, I noticed the sheep didn't even come to it, the feeder. They went out to the pasture and were nibbling all afternoon and evening. So they can gorge themselves on that, which is an issue. So probably the best thing to do is to let them in for a few hours and give them hay for a few days till the grass can come up. And then and they can eat hay and a little bit of and get used to it.
That's like so hard to do, though, because the grass is green and they're at the gate and you know they want it and they haven't had it all winter and it means so much to them. It's really hard to deny them.
Well, it's hard for some people to deny. I know some farmers it's not hard.
We have three different pastures that we can close off so that they can, you know, we can rotate the grazing and they don't eat it down too much. It's kind of like having to keep Fate in the crate because she had a cut on her foot.
Which we didn't do either.
I know. That's what I'm saying. We're not very good at that.
She's still limping.
She's only limping a little bit, but she's getting better every day. And we're just not so good at that.
So this is one of those things where, is this what the animals need or what the people who have them need? This is one of our long-running discussions, my long-running writing. So this is a question where what the sheep really need right now for them is to graze for a few hours and to get hay, and then to be locked out of the pasture until they get used to the new diet, until the grass can come up. If they're let on the pasture all day long, they're going to eat the grass down and wreck it. So later in the summer, we're going to miss it. And also, it's healthier for them because their stomachs are going to get roiled by eating all that nutritious sugar after a winter of hay. So my vote would be that we just let them graze. We can compromise. Let them graze half the day, give them a little hay, and then next week just stop hay altogether would be my idea.
Well, I think we talk about this every spring. We kind of have this conversation.
Yes, we do.
And we make all these plans. We're going to close off the pasture in the afternoon, or we'll close this gate and open that gate. And like half the time, we just don't do it.
And why is that, do you think?
I don't know, because we're working and we don't think about it, or it's not that important. You know, we're not real farmers.
Real farmers would be sure not putting out much hay anymore.
We're just kind of weird. It's just the way we are, I guess.
And we also, there is the idea that perhaps we can't bear to deny them.
Well, I think that's
a big part
of it.
I don't want to mention any names.
Well, you're the one who the donkeys, you're in your office writing, and the donkeys start making those little nickering braying noises, and you run out and give them a treat.
I don't do that.
If I did that, I'd be doing it all day long.
They have my number.
I know.
I don't do it all day. I just do it when they catch me, catch me outside.
Yeah.
They have a special bray for me, a soft bray.
They do that little nicker.
This has been for 10, 15 years this has been happening. And I remember when I was in the first Bedlam farm, my study looked out over the barn, and that monster Elvis, the steer, they would spot me, and they would start working on me. They would, you know, moo or bray or softly, and I would come and give them something. I couldn't resist them.
And that's when you realized that they had trained you.
They had trained. That's right. They trained me. I wasn't training them.
They said to their friends, the sheep, hey, watch this. We're going to get John to come out and give us a treat.
Oh, it was like clockwork. At noon, he would come. The cow would come up to the gate and look at me and start bellowing for hay. And I'd go and give him a handful.
Or a donut.
That's true. He'd love donuts. Elvis loved donuts. So, well, you're not exactly, you know.
I'm tough. I am so tough when it comes to those animals.
Dudley Do-Right? You're not exactly Dudley Do-Right. who's the guy in Popeye?
I don't know.
Brutus. You're not exactly Brutus.
Oh. Anyway, no.
So, well, I think the right thing to do is to ease them into this new diet. And we're probably not going to do it meticulously, but we can move in that direction. I can talk about it. And you also pointed out this morning that the great thing about spring and late spring is we don't have to get up early in the morning.
On Saturday and Sunday, you let the dogs out in the backyard and you go back to bed.
Right.
And you don't have to go out and feed the animals. You don't have to get the fires going. There's so much you don't have to do in the summer, in the morning, that you have to do in the winter. And it's like a little vacation every day.
It's right. And then for 6 months. However, for me, this is also the time of year where I start thinking about winter. I'm like the quartermaster here. So I have to start thinking about what it means, calling the wood guy, calling the hay people, figure out how much hay you want, ordering it, getting it delivered. And we're going to need 7 cords of wood for our wood stoves.
Yeah, we seem to do pretty good with the wood. We have a little bit left over. I don't think we're going to use it. It's probably, it's not a full cord. But we'll move that into the woodshed. And then throughout the year, throughout the summer, we'll get piles of wood delivered.
And do you
stack them?
Do you think we use more or less wood than we did last year?
I think we used about the same amount. We had about the same amount left over.
Last year was colder. I think it was a harder winter.
I don't know. I think we used about the same amount of wood. Yeah.
It's like a nasty period in January, and that wasn't too bad otherwise.
Yeah. It was a pretty easy year.
So this all starts right about now. You know, I have to start making these calls now to make sure you get your orders in.
Right. So spring comes, and then you have to think about winter.
Immediately. And winter is the big month, as far as I'm concerned, for planning. You don't really have to plan so much for the other seasons.
It's true.
But winter, you really do have to plan for. You don't want to be sitting there, at least me, I'm manic about this. You don't want to be sitting there in October, where am I going to get the wood and where am I going to get the hay? Lots of times it's gone, the price goes up, and things can go. And I've had that happen to me in the first Bedlam farm, where I started doing this in late August, October.
Yeah, you can't really do that.
You can't do that.
And the wood isn't dry. You know what I was just thinking too, that, you know, I always have this idea that the summer is easier when it comes to the animals than the winter. But of course, there are all these things that happen in the summer that you don't have to do in the winter. And I'm just thinking of the fences, how already the sheep have gotten out of the fences because they're looking at the grass on the other side.
Right.
And in the winter, there's nothing appealing there because it's snow and it's brown. But I was just down in the one pasture today where the geese were, and I saw some of their wool on the fence.
You mean right close by?
Right in the barnyard. So they're going into that little, it's marshy there, so they're not going to go there, and there's not a lot for them to eat. But I did find, you know, they go through the fence and their wool gets stuck on the wire. And so they've been.
Because it's not electrified because of all the water.
Right. So they've been going through there.
They did that last year too, I think.
I know.
But then I think that gets very thick.
Then it gets thick. It grows up. So it's like, it's definitely a seasonal thing. You know, it's like the spring.
In the summer,
they can go through and they get old brambles. Yeah, the fences get brambles grow up around them. So they can't get through it again.
So it seems to be only one or two of them do that.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's true. And there's
so
nothing
they won't
really
go far if the others are in there.
Right. And there's nothing really great there. And they do come back. But,
okay, Red, go lie down, boy. Red, come on, lie down.
That was Red shaking his head and hitting his ear against the garbage pail.
What's this? Live podcast in real time. That's a new Red. Sound. We haven't heard that
no,
sound
No, we
before.
Haven't. And Red is, we were going to talk a little bit about Red.
Yeah, let's talk about Red.
You wrote a nice piece about Red and where he is in his life on your blog yesterday.
You know, Red is failing, as I think I've written. Some of you may know that. Red is a, for some of you who don't know that, he's an 11, 12-year-old border collie from Northern Ireland. He's been my pal and soulmate and therapy dog and many other things for some years now. He was given to me by a wonderful woman in Virginia who read one of my books and thought that God wanted me to have the dog. It scared me the daylights out of me. So I don't usually get my dogs from God. What if it doesn't work out? But he has worked out, and she was right. It was a beautiful match. And he's done amazing things for me. He is failing. He's going blind. He's going deaf and getting confused. So in the afternoons, we go out and sit, and he can look at the sheep without doing anything. They're kind of ignoring him now for the first time. This was a great herding dog, a great herding dog. So I think I write a lot about grieving. how I have some unusual ideas about grieving. You know, I think having dogs is a great joy to me, and I don't want to turn it into a misery. So when a dog like Red dies, I want to make sure to celebrate his life and be grateful to it. I certainly will be sad, but I don't want to make it into a morbid, years-long grieving, missing him, marking anniversaries, all that stuff that I don't like to see on social media. So, and I don't really grieve past that. I will certainly cry when he goes or when he's put down or when he dies, and I'll feel it. But there's a line for me where I don't want to go. And, you know, death is a part of life. One of the things Red has brought me is an understanding of mortality through our hospice work and our therapy work with the elderly, where we deal with sickness and death all the time and mortality. So I've done a lot of thinking about it. I've witnessed a great deal of it. And I think, Red has had a great life, and I've had a great life with him. And I'm happy about it. I'm pleased about it. I'm grateful for it. So I definitely will feel sad. I definitely will do some grieving, but I will move forward. And, you know, the wonderful thing about getting a dog is you can get another one.
Now, Red is pretty special. I mean, have you ever had a dog like Red before?
No.
What's so different about him? I mean, Rose, you were very close to Rose. It was at a different point in your life. But there's something about Red that it makes us, he will be missed in a different way on the farm. And I think in your life.
Definitely. Well, you know, Rose was a very professional relationship.
Right.
Rose was really a working dog.
Yeah, the emotional.
She didn't sleep in bed. She didn't want to be cuddled. You know, she was not there to snuggle with me. And she hated when people tried to snuggle with her. She didn't want anything to do with it. But I loved her very much. She's a great dog. Red is a much more emotional experience. He weaves into your life. He's always with me. He always is near me. He sleeps at the foot of the bed. He goes, rides in the car everywhere I go. He goes to the dentist. He's amazing in his therapy work. He's an incredible herding dog. He was an incredible herding dog. So when he got out of that car that brought him there, he's just my dog.
And he's always there. If you ever say, "Where's Red?" he's always right at your heel. I mean, he's always right next to you. You know.
Yeah, I always look around and say, "Where is he?" He's always right there.
He's always right there.
And the work he's done in therapy is incredible. He's helped many people leave the world with warmth and dignity.
And that's something he still can do. The therapy
still does
work.
He's just failing. His heart is failing. His eyes are failing. His ears are failing. And he's had some severe spinal difficulties, which have been very, very painful for him. And the other thing about me, and I think you too, we've talked a lot about this over the years. I don't feel I should be letting him suffer. So once I think he's really suffering, I'm going to want him to put him down.
Right, which makes me think about the sheep that we have who are getting old.
The bony sheep, the two bony sheep. Why don't you talk about them?
Well, we have, I have to clear my throat.
Is this because you're sad or because you're...
No, just because my throat.
And here you never know, right?
Or maybe I'm sad. Maybe I'm thinking about, we're talking about our dying animals. So we have these two sheep, Zelda and Grizel. And when we had them shorn, we could see how skinny they actually were, that they were not able to gain weight. And we didn't realize this because they had all their wool on them. So one of them, Zelda, only has two teeth in the front, so she's having a hard time eating. Grizel has her teeth, but it really looks like she's having a much harder time gaining weight. Zelda has already gained some weight since we had her shorn. You could see her plumping out a little, and Grizel hasn't. So we're giving them grain, which should help. It's like a nutritional
supplement.
I should
have the problem with no sheep is she can't grind the hay.
Right, she can't.
The grass.
She can't, so she can't take the food in. So when I heard that, when our shearer told us that, I thought we should not. I don't want Zelda to starve to death. You know, I don't want her to go through another winter where she can't eat and she's hungry all the time and she basically starves to death. And I thought it's probably best if we put her down. And now there's a difference between our relationship with the sheep and with the dogs. I mean, you often talk about this, John, and the cats. And the sheep are not, I'm not as close to the sheep as I am to my dogs, you know.
But you're close to them because of the wool.
I'm close to them because I know them by name and I know their personalities, but they don't live in the house with us. It is different. And I do have
And they're dumb
a
as
different,
fence posts.
They're not so dumb. I do have a different idea about them. And I do, it is separate. It is, you know, it is separate. I feel different about them than I do the donkeys. You know, I feel closer to the donkeys. I feel more attached to the donkeys than I do the sheep. And I'm very attached to Zelda. She's one of my first sheep. I've had her, you know, from the very beginning. But which is also why I wouldn't want her to suffer. You know, I don't want her to have to go through that just to make me feel good, like I'm doing something for her. She doesn't have to.
So one of the things we're facing is winter approaches in a few months again. Do we want to put them through another winter?
And we have to see. I think we have to see how well they do, you know, and then make that decision.
I think we talked about this the other day, that, you know, the idea that mercy is not only about keeping things alive. Sometimes mercy on a farm is about letting things go. And I think, yes, of the two, I look at Grizel, who is really almost a mere, her bones are,
she's
sticking
very,
out,
very skinny.
And I think she's really just very, very old.
Yeah.
And they don't have fat on their bones like that. Winters are very tough on them.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's one that I would keep an eye on in terms of thinking about, would it be a merciful thing to let her go around August or September so she doesn't have to do that again? On the other hand, she's always been like that.
Yeah, they are skinnier. They do have a different body type. They don't, they're different. They're Romneys, and they do have a different body type than the Border Luster and the Cheviots that we have, who are very round. So, you know, I think that's part of it. She also had an infection in her foot, which Liz the Shearer trimmed her foot, and we put some peroxide on it, and she limped for another 2 days, and now she's running on it fine. So that says she is able to heal. You know, she still has something going on in there, you know.
Well, you know, over the years, you know, I like to say the farm is a great teacher, and certainly teaches about life or death. And, you know, we live in a twilight zone in a sense, because there are pet people and animal people. People who live with animals are very different than people who live with pets.
Yeah.
They have just a whole different perspective on it. And people will email me all the time and ask me questions like, how could you be so cruel as to share them in November? But that's when you're supposed to share them. That's
right.
When they recover their wool very quickly and are fine for the winter. But things that people drive by farmers and say, well, the horses are lying down, and they call the police.
Because they think they're dead.
Taking a nap.
You know? The horse is sleep lying down.
Horse is sleep lying down. So, you know, there's a very different way of looking at it. And people with pets tend to think that love is equatable with keeping something alive for as long as you possibly can at any cost. People with animals, you can't do that on a farm. If one thing, you'd go broke in a minute. And for another, I don't think it's humane. I think it's the opposite.
I don't even think it's humane with people to do
that. No, I don't either.
You know, I mean, it's their choice. But for myself, I don't think it's humane with people. I mean, we have the opportunity to do it with our pets.
We learned this with Rocky, the 38-year-old blind pony, who we decided to spare another winter. Many people were very angry at us about that. It doesn't bother me that much, but. But, you know, it's always a tricky decision.
It is. It is a tricky decision. And you know, the thing is, you're responsible for it. I'm responsible for it. If I say we need to put Zelda down, I'm the one who's making that decision. I'm the one who's responsible. I mean, we do it together.
Right.
But, you know, you take responsibility for it. And you say, this is what I believe to be best.
We have a nice rule that has avoided conflict and helped us come even closer together about this sort of thing, where we each have veto power. So no animal's getting put down unless we both say it's okay. And no animal comes to the farm unless we both say it's okay. No animal leaves unless we both say it's okay. So there's a point at which Maria can say to me, well, I don't want Grizel to go now. So she doesn't. I mean, that's sort of the end of it. So it doesn't become an eternal argument or a problem, you know. And you know, we do. I'm probably a little quicker with the rifle than you are.
I think so. And then we also have
one of my book reviews, the New York Times, said John Katz has a gun and he's not afraid to use it. Sort of startled me.
Makes you sound like John Wayne.
I know. I thought, whoa, I'm like a guy, like a real guy.
I've seen you use that gun maybe three times.
Well, there were the roosters and some snow. More than that, sheep.
Oh,
lamb,
the rooster, the sick lamb, the rabbit,
some
skunk.
Chickens. Sick chickens.
Yeah,
maybe the one that got eaten
true.
By the fox. No, it's been quite a few times.
That's true. That's
rabbit
true.
Raccoons.
Over the years, yeah. No, and over, and then there was the one time you were shooting at the woodpecker that was on the house, which was.
I deny that. I deny that whole story. I guess you should have to tell them what that was now.
Oh, so there was a woodpecker that was trying to pecking. This is the old Bedlam Farm, and it was pecking at the. At the roof of the house, trying to eat bugs or make a nest or whatever it was doing. And so John comes out with his rifle and he starts shooting at it. As if
he was building a hole in the house.
As if you could hit it, for one thing.
It wasn't that far.
Yeah, but there was
I'm not a bad shot.
A pileated woodpecker. It was one of those small woodpeckers. And you're shooting at the house, for God's sake.
I deny that. That's not true. I deny that story.
That was the best. That never happened.
And I missed.
Thank God you missed. But it's true. You have taken that gun out.
He was trying to pick a hole in our house.
One time you defended me beautifully when that rooster kept attacking me.
It was attacking you. I said to him, you know, you're not the biggest rooster here. I took him out and shot him.
And the hens were so happy, actually, without him around. Remember?
They did like a hen dance.
They did. They were like, oh, freedom, because he was always keeping them contained. He was always keeping them.
He got rid of the man.
Right. And then after that, they roamed around the farm. They were free. They really enjoyed themselves.
It's a disturbing metaphor. What's the problem? Well, you know, the farm is a great cultural teacher in many ways. I lived in urban areas my whole life, near New York and Washington and Boston and New Jersey and all these places. And only the bad guys had guns. All the bad guys had guns. Up here, all the good guys have guns. And if somebody tried to take my rifle away, I would be pretty bent out of shape about it. I need that thing.
You do need it. I always say that I'm going to learn how to shoot it because, you know, if you're not around, I mean, if there's a rabid animal, if there's a rabid raccoon or, you know, an animal that is dying and you want to put out of its misery, it makes sense to have it. And that happens here. And there's no one to call when that happens.
Well, that's the thing. And also, you know, I took lessons and I wanted to know how to shoot well because it's also, you don't want to be injuring an animal.
Yeah.
You want death to be very quick.
You
want to
do it right.
I'm actually quite proud of myself. I picked off that rooster with one shot. And
that's
he was right
impressive.
Dead. And even the lambs I had to shoot, which was the roughest thing.
That was awful.
But I know how to make it very quick now.
Yeah.
So that's a way of ending their suffering.
Yeah.
If you do it, but you have to know what you're doing. You have to be very careful safety-wise, and you have to be very careful how you shoot an animal.
That's one of those things where I say, I want to learn how to shoot a gun, but, you know, it's another thing that I haven't done because I really don't want to.
I remember the rooster episode. I forget his name. You remember his name? That rooster, little monster. We've had some mean temper. It's a sweet rooster and some mean roosters.
Most of them have been mean. We've only had one nice rooster. We don't get roosters anymore.
Winston was the nice rooster. He's
no more
a doll.
Roosters.
So this guy attacks Maria right in the yard.
Oh, every time I walked out in the yard, he would come after me. And the last time he did it, he grabbed onto my leg, had his claws stuck in my leg. And I was like screaming, trying to get him off of my leg, and I couldn't get him off my leg.
So this stirred all my testosterone, getting bubbling and boiling over, and I ran and grabbed the rifle, pursued him out into the pasture. I remember saying to him, you son of a bitch, you're not the biggest rooster here. I shot him.
And you know,
and it felt good. I don't care what anybody says.
I felt a little bad, but ultimately I did not feel bad because every time I walked out into the yard, I was afraid I was going to get attacked. And I thought, I can't live here if I have to worry about getting attacked.
And this guy
had
a good life. He had a good life. He messed
it
up big time.
He messed up big time.
So, but those things, you know, you see a rabid raccoon crawling around the yard in the middle of the night. You know, they're really, I remember the first time I called the police and they said, you have a gun?
Yeah, that's what they said. You have a gun?
Yeah.
And I did that too. And then I said, no. And he said, well, you have a neighbor who has a gun? You know, that's their solution.
I know. They're not going to come for that.
Right.
I think I've told this story in one of my books, but on my very first night living up here, I woke up in the morning and I was up on the mountain. When I wrote Running to the Mountain, I'd never been up in the country for any time by myself. And I look out the window and there's a cow staring at me through the kitchen pane. And I looked at the cow and I said, shoo! I yelled at him and she didn't move. So I called 911 and the sheriff answered. I said, listen, there's a cow looking in my backyard looking at me. And there's a long pause and he goes, where are you from? I said, I just came here from New Jersey. And he's trying not to laugh. And he said, why don't you just relax? And the cow will probably go back where she came from, which she did. She disappeared a few hours later. But then many years later, just 2 years ago, I was telling that story to a farmer near the area where I was taking pictures and near where I'd seen the cow. I'd moved since then. And I told him the story and he says, oh, I know that cow. That was on McLeod's farm. He was right, came from the bottom. She walked up there every morning to graze and then came back.
It's great.
So living up here,
it's very different. I remember when I first moved up here, how just seeing cows was exciting. And we live in a place where dairy farms are, you know, they're predominant in the area. So you're gonna
they're dying, unfortunately, many.
They are. But
I think the farm, I always say the farm is my mother in many ways. The farm is a teacher. I mean, you confront all of these issues all the time. Even things like, hey, you have to pay attention, you know, to the nature. You have to pay attention to the weather. You have to look and see how the grass is doing. It just connects you to the earth in a very powerful way.
Yes, and it's very basic. I mean, this is, you know, food and shelter. This is life and death.
And responsibility. You're responsible for these animals.
Yeah. And so you become very aware. You become very connected to the natural world. And it's a beautiful thing. And even though we're not farmers, you know, and we do have these animals, and so it connects us in a way where we do have this responsibility for them. And we're in nature all the time because of it. You know, it's become such a big part of us. We know the weather. It's important.
You up in the morning, you look at the weather, you see what the weather is, and it matters.
It matters.
Do all day.
Yeah.
It matters with the animals. You know, you have become connected to nature. You always have been, I think, more than me in many ways. In a very personal way, your walks in the woods, but also in your art. And I think I wanted to talk a little bit about, I want to mention one thing on these podcasts. We're going to talk about the news of the week on the farm, what's happening, but also we're going to talk about our lives and how they have shaped our lives together. I want to talk at some point about how we've learned to deal with fear and anxiety. I want to talk about how the Army of Good and how that has really grounded me during this tense period in the country's life. But I wrote down this morning that I really wanted to talk about your goddesses. You have a goddess thing going, and I know we talked about you're talking about that and how you're doing that and what it means to you and where the ideas come from.
Well, I've always, you know, ever since I started making my art about 10 years ago, I started making these, what I called everyday goddesses, saying that we're all goddesses. And it has just evolved from there. Right now I'm working on one that I'm calling, she's I Am Enough. And I spoke about this on the other podcast. I spoke about her. But they are connected. They're connected to the natural, what were you asking me?
How to the natural world. And you know, you were talking this morning about, you wanted to talk about how you're making them.
Well, the one that I'm making now, it's kind of an interesting thing because people send me old quilts and I take the quilt and I remove parts of it. I cut it up. And like the one that I'm working on now, what happens sometimes is that I'll look at the piece and it tells me what to do. I think that's what I wanted to talk about, how it tells me what to do. And sometimes I can't see it. I forgot what I wanted to talk about.
You had that great, like, kind of black look. Like, what is he asking me this for?
We were talking about animals, and now you want me to switch to goddesses?
Well, you know me, man. We go from one place to another.
That's not so easy to do. But so I had this thing where I knew she had, so the shape of the quilt and the design of the original quilt, which was an old quilt, hand-stitched, really helped dictate the shape of the goddess and what she looked like. And I knew where her hands were supposed to be because of that. And so for weeks now, I've been looking and thinking, okay, I know her hands are supposed to be there, but I can't see them. I just can't picture it. And so last Friday, I did a drawing of her and what I thought her hands should look like. And that was pretty easy to do, but I still couldn't see them. And then when I came in on Monday morning, I looked at the piece, the quilt that's hanging on my wall, and all of a sudden her hands were there. I could see them, you know? And I think it's one of the wonderful things that happens. This happens with me when I'm making my quilts all the time. I make my quilts, I don't plan them. I just sew two pieces of fabric together, then I sew another piece of fabric on, then another piece of fabric on. So it's a real intuitive process, and I really have to trust it and trust myself. But sometimes I stop and I just look, at the quilt, and I don't know what to do. But if I look at it long enough, or I look at it at the right time, all of a sudden I will see what I have to do next. I literally see in the empty spaces what it should be. And I don't know where that comes from. I don't know if that's, I think it's the piece talking to me saying, this is what I want to be.
The goddess is political in your mind?
Oh, sure. Oh, absolutely.
How so?
Well, because, I mean, you can go all the way back to the idea of the goddess that came before our male god. You know, you think about our male god who creates life. It's like, you know, life doesn't come from men. Life comes from women. And the goddess was very, very powerful being, and women were very powerful, and because they were the life source. And so when, you know, how do we get women to give away their power, or how do we take power away from women? You know, all of a sudden they're not the birth givers. They're not the source of life. And, you know, that's been going on for thousands of years.
So they become very important.
Well, I feel like, especially now with the politics that are going on, and how with our president, how women have really come up and said, you know what, we're not going to stand for this. You know, we're not going to let things go on as they have been going on. And it's this resurgence, and I feel it in my art. I mean, it comes out in my art.
Well, I've noticed this emergence of this, what I call feminist art in your work. Not only that, but
definitely, there's definitely my work.
Not to mention your vulvas, the famous vulvas.
My flying vulvas are very feminist.
And you have a flying vulva sticker on your car.
Yeah.
I haven't put one on my car yet.
Yeah, well, what are you afraid?
I am a little bit afraid.
You see, men, for some reason, what are you afraid of a vulva
well,
for?
I'm not afraid
What's
of your vulva, but I'm... We don't
What's
want to get. We don't need to go
of?
There. Well, it's just you know.
What is it? It is true. What?
I've never put political stuff on my car, and so it's a political statement.
It is political. It's also very personal.
But you know, one of the ways that I've dealt with the last few years, as people know, is I decided what I'm going to do is I'm just going to do good small acts of kindness, and sharing, and helping looking to people who are needy and people who are vulnerable. And I think, and for me, it's just being only for me. I've really avoided overt political statements and things.
Yeah.
Except my work is very political to me. And every time I help somebody, every time I do go to the mansion, every time I help a refugee kid, I'm making a political statement in my mind.
It is political. And that's that idea that, you know, what we do personally is political. It is, you know.
So that's how I've chosen to do it. So I'm very wary of making any political, because then right away people label you and blah, blah, blah. Although I love the AAA guy who came over to help your car tire and looked at the vulva, and he looked at me and he said, is that a vulva? He said, what's
that's
that?
A beautiful thing.
I said, it's a long story, but we celebrate vulvas here. You know, the refugee thing is very important to me. My come from a family of refugees, my grandmother, my parent, and it's very important work to me. And I never cast it in a political light. I just do it and write about it. I think people get it. So that's how I've kind of navigated it. All right, so I think we're running out of time. Not that we have a fixed time.
No, but I think we're on to about a half hour, because I set my timer about 10 minutes.
It was that
after,
goddess stuff. There's no stopping that. No, I love when you talk about the goddess. So on the podcast, I hope you're getting a feel for them. We're just going to, really essentially, this is the conversations we usually have and life on the farm that we're going to do once a week. What's going on the farm? And sharing some of the conversations this is a household of conversations. We have conversations from dawn to dusk.
It's a very wonderful thing.
It's a wonderful thing for me too. We have these conversations all the time, and we work things out, and we support each other, and we support other people, and blah, blah, blah. And so that's what we're doing. We're sharing the conversations. They're very real. You know, if Red bangs into the trash can, he bangs into the trash can.
And we kind of had some ideas that we were going to talk about that we didn't get to, because our conversation just took us off in a different direction.
Always the case around here.
Yeah.
Okay, so I see our green button on the microphone is still working. This is all recording, and we're going to put this up today as podcast number 3. We're going to talk about fear, but I guess we'll do that maybe next time.
We'll have to do it next time.
Take care. Happy spring to you all.
Yeah, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.